What is enlightenment? I thought I'd just try something modest, essentially. Actually, what I'd like to do is I'd like to start with a short guided meditation. Yeah? So if you want to just take a comfortable position, this is short, you know, 7 minutes, maybe 7-8 minutes. But find a posture like the one that you meditated in, if you've just meditated with us, or if you haven't meditated before and you're new and you're joining us, perhaps find a posture that allows you to sit in a comfortably alert and erect position with your head, neck, and back in general alignment without being stiff or tense, so that ideally you have a sense of being alert and awake on the one hand, and relaxed and at ease as you settle back into the moment. As is often the case with guided meditations, let's begin by becoming aware of our breathing. If you're comfortable allowing your eyes to close, you can have them closed as we do this. If you prefer, you could have them gently downcast with a soft focus. And just let your attention ride the breath as you notice it on the level of sensation as you inhale and as you exhale. Not trying to manipulate the breath or control the breath, and just letting it come and go of its own accord, and gently returning the attention to the felt sensations of the breath when the mind wanders. As you do this, allow your thoughts and feelings to gently settle in the way that silt settles to the bottom of a pond when you stop stirring it. Just letting everything come to rest. Now I'd like you to imagine yourself descending a long staircase, one step at a time. You might want to count the stairs as you go down. At the bottom of the stairs, there is a door. Over the door is written the word enlightenment. Someone will hand you a key to the door. When they do, open the door and go through it. See what you find on the other side. Explore the space you find yourself in, getting to know it. As you explore your surroundings, see if you find anything there that you'd like to bring back with you. If you do, give yourself permission to bring it back. Take your time. There's no need to hurry. And now get ready to return. When you're ready, walk back through the door. Go back up the stairs. And as you do, remember that you can return to this place should you ever choose to do so. And when you're ready, allow your eyes to gently open and simply be here once again. Resting in your own being, feeling fully awake and aware. So I'm curious, let me just check in and see if anybody would be willing to say a couple of words about what you noticed in that guided experience. What you want to understand, of course, is that this is done in the spirit of discovery. There's not a right or wrong way to do it. I'm just curious what you experienced. Anybody feel like jumping in? Any of you online as well, I'd be interested in hearing from. Please. Hold the mic nice and close and point it like an ice cream cone.
Truth is, I didn't find much, and I didn't find anything to bring back. Mm-hmm. I found a white, big room with nothing but the door I just came through, so that's... not very creative or imaginative, but that's what I found when I got there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as I said, we're not looking for a right answer. Yeah, thank you. Somebody else? Right here, we've got someone who will share.
Thank you for that exercise.
Tilted a little. There you
go. Oh, yeah. A couple of years ago, I woke up in the middle of the night feeling like there was a presence in my apartment. And it's extremely stilling. I realized that there was just something in the air. And I sat down on my bed, and my cat, who had gone through a trauma, came and sat in my lap. And I was so compelled by the feeling that something was there that I woke up my sister, and she asked, "Who's here?" Like, that was the first question she woke up with. And it still to this day, I reflect on it, but I haven't been able to go back there. And so when you took me through the exercise, that is the place that I found. And it did vanish more quickly than I think I was just trying to grasp and to hold on to it. And then it went away even before I left the room. But it was a really nice reminder. I felt it in my body. Mm-hmm.
Great. Thank you. Anyone else? Be willing to say a little bit? Right over here.
And then, David, we have someone online as well afterwards.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead, please, and hold it close.
Sure. So going down a long set of stairs, what am I familiar with? It's the subway. I just imagine going down, down, down. Open a door, and I'm in a high meadow, big open area of just grass, and it felt good. Felt very good. And then coming back, it was just bringing with me a sense of well-being and all that spaciousness that was around me.
Great. Thank you. Go ahead, Nicholas, if you've got someone online.
Okay, Scott.
Yeah, I definitely felt, as I entered that room, a sense of lightness and well-being. It felt good. And anyways, I think I'm going to continue with that exercise from time to time. So thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah. Go ahead.
I walked down the stairs. I felt like I was in this building. But when I opened the door, I felt like I saw the universe. Like, I have been looking at these pictures of outer space. I have been looking.
There it is.
I've been looking at pictures of outer space from the James Webb telescope lately. And that's what I saw, and I opened the door. And I don't know. That's all. It was kind of overpowering. Uh-huh. A little frightening. Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. I'll take it. So part of what I want you to notice here is the variation, the range of associations we have with this word. This is a really simple device to check in with some of the unconscious associations we have with this word enlightenment.
Mm-hmm.
I want you to notice the variation, and then I want to flip this. That's kind of right side of the brain, what we just did, right? I want to flip it to the left side of the brain. And I'd like you to do a little thought experiment with me, if you're willing to do it, and then we'll talk about it as well. And if it really helps with this kind of experiment if you use your imagination as fully as you're able. Yeah. And what I'd like you to imagine is that you have a friend who comes to visit you, who speaks English as a second language. Yeah. And they're not familiar with Dharma or Buddhist teachings. And you invite them to come to a Dharma talk. Right? And in the course of that talk, the teacher uses the word enlightenment several times. So when you go out for coffee afterwards, your friend asks a question, right? Partly because English is a second language, partly because Buddhism's not familiar. And the question is, this word enlightenment, right? The teacher used it numerous times. What does it mean? And if you had to answer that in two sentences, three at the most, in a way that you could explain to your friend, yeah? What would you say? This is someone you care about. You're kind of pleased and excited that maybe they'd be interested in Dharma teachings. This word enlightenment, what does it mean? What would you say? Let's get a mic over to you. Just a sec.
Oh,
Yeah, he'll bring it to you. And hold it nice and close like an ice cream cone. Yeah.
Living in the light of acceptance of all that is. Yeah.
Living in the light of acceptance of all that is. Uh-huh. Great. Wonderful. Yeah, please.
I'm accepting this long walk.
No, he'll meet you partway.
What came to my mind was complete abandonment of all clinging whatsoever. It's kind of from this point forward.
Complete abandonment of all clinging from this point forward.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Great. Great. These are good. Someone else? Think about it. This is a chance to get extra credit for class participation.
Since I'm an overachiever.
Go for it.
Absolute freedom at the same time as absolute connection.
Absolute freedom at the same time as absolute connection. Great. Mm. Yeah, anyone at home have anything on this one?
Somebody shared seeing things for what they are.
Uh-huh. Which is one of the classical definitions of the word vipassana. Yeah? Seeing things as they are, seeing things clearly. Okay. So part of why I wanted to do these little experiments is because the word enlightenment, as I think a lot of us have come to see, can be understood in a variety of different ways. I've been fascinated with this question of what enlightenment is since I first got involved with spiritual teachings as a 21-year-old undergraduate student. And in a sense, I've been exploring it pretty regularly ever since, either directly and in a focused manner or indirectly through exploring Buddhist and other contemplative practices. I think it's useful to recognize that an essential element of Buddhist practice is the vision of the practice, right? What's the North Star that we have in our heart and mind when we set out on the Buddhist path of awakening or enlightenment? Yeah. Personally, I think enlightenment is a little bit of a problematic word for a few reasons. And the word bodhi, which is the Pali language word that is being translated, most scholars would agree is actually more accurately translated as awakening, as in the root word for Buddha, B-U-D-D-H, right? One who is awakened. But when Buddhism first started to come to the West, the people who encountered it actually intentionally wanted to associate it with the European Enlightenment, which had positive connotations for Western people. That's been somewhat problematic for a variety of reasons. And what I think a lot of us may have noticed is what I noticed in my own practice over the years. And that was that different teachers in different traditions, both within Buddhism and in other religious and spiritual traditions like Hinduism and Sufism and contemplative Christianity and so forth, used the word enlightenment at times, and it was unclear to me if they were talking about the same thing or not. Yeah. So a number of questions started to come up for me, that some of which might be familiar to some of you. So when I was first introduced to meditation, it was in the context of yoga in my early 20s. As a college student, I got involved with hatha yoga and meditation and then other aspects of a yogic way of life, and felt very inspired and trained as a yoga teacher. And the word enlightenment had certain connotations. It was sometimes a translation of the Sanskrit word moksha, which is also translated as liberation. And I noticed that there were a variety of synonyms that were used interchangeably with enlightenment a lot. Words like freedom, as you mentioned, the word liberation, the word awakening, which I've already mentioned. Various other words would come up. Yeah? And then when I got involved with Buddhist teachings, I also started to notice that within the different schools of Buddhist teaching, the word also had different connotations and associations. So when my insight meditation teachers, who were rooted in the Theravada tradition, talked about enlightenment, they seemed to talk about it as with a certain flavor, if you will. When I explored Zen teachings at a certain point, began to read and then study a bit in the Zen tradition, there was a different feel to the way the word enlightenment was used. And then later, when I went to Asia and lived in Nepal and studied with Tibetan teachers, there was yet a different quality associated with enlightenment. Yeah. So I started to ask myself, are all these people talking about the same thing? If you will, right? Does that make sense? Anyone relate to this? One thing I noticed that was different across traditions was that some people talked about enlightenment as if it were a single solitary experience. So when they used that word, they were talking about enlightened experience, a moment of seeing clearly, as we talked about, a moment of feel connecting with everything, feeling free, a moment of unconditional love in some cases, where a heart just flew open, and instead of feeling contracted and lonely and hurt, as our hearts often do, there was a sense of what Sharon Salzberg calls a heart as wide as the world, and a deep, deep compassion that we humans have a potential for. Yeah? Other times when people would talk about enlightenment, they would talk about it as if a person had had an experience of that sort and was therefore completely and fully, quote unquote, enlightened for life. That's very different than talking about an experience where a door or a gate flies open and there's a crack in the cosmic egg, so to speak, and we see really clearly what's happening. But then usually because of our conditioning, that gate closes again and we come back into our small sense of self and a sense of contraction. And as a lot of us have experienced, I think, the spiritual journey in some ways is a process of continual expansion and contraction of consciousness. Yeah. Let's look at a couple of examples. We have a retreat center in Colorado called the Rocky Mountain Eco Dharma Retreat Center that we've had for about 6 years now, where I teach usually a couple times a year. 2 years ago, someone came to one of my retreats there. It was a week-long retreat. And at the end, sent me an email, which he kindly gave me permission to share. And he describes an experience he had. He was out doing walking meditation, which I think maybe all of you are familiar with. And this is the experience he described. A glimpse, on silent retreat 2 weeks ago, during a period of walking meditation, a sudden fluttering appeared in front of my face, a hummingbird. I became so instantly still, not even my pupils shifted to focus on what was happening. After a moment, it flew up close into my beard and was poking around on my chin, gentle yet firm, and with the same pressure each time. Then it pulled back, paused, and went right up my left nostril. It poked around up there 5 or 6 times, and again pulled back and paused before going up my right nostril. Up until that moment, I'd had no thought. Okay, this is emptiness of self. I'd had no thought, right? total stillness. Now notice how he describes this part. Awareness was experiencing the process I call hummingbird as not separate from the totality, as awareness was also not separate. After a couple of pokes up the right nostril, a thought, will it move up to poke my eye? In this moment, the hummingbird moved back, took one last look, and flew away. And then he writes, I imagined that when I, in quotes, wondered if it, in quotes, was going to poke my eye, a thin layer of identity and separateness had been created, leaving me in awe. Okay. Now that's an experience that sometimes is called non-duality, right? Where we have a sense of a separate self on the level of subject and object, right? I see a hummingbird, right? And then the sense of personal boundary dissolves and breaks down, and there's no separateness in the situation. There's just presence with what is, and the sense of identity has expanded to everything, essentially, right? At the same time, what happened near the end, there was a contraction when the thought came up, what if it goes for my eye, right? And things contracted. Now, this is not easy territory to put into words, because when we talk about non-duality or enlightenment, what happens, of course, is that the limitations of language show up really quickly. Specifically, if you look at the English language, it's designed around subject and object. So built into the language and the thought process is this dualistic perspective on the nature of reality. The people that come closest to finding language for talking about what enlightenment is about oftentimes are poets and mystics. One of the great Chinese Zen poets, Li Po, for example, wrote a couple of simple couplets where you can see the same movement that this person experienced, except in the other direction. That is, going from two to one. Right? In this case, there was two, there was a perceiver and a hummingbird, and then there was just unity, one space in which it was all happening without a separate sense of self. And then it opened back into subject and object, right? Li Po's couplets, right? The birds have vanished into the sky, and now the last cloud drains away. We sit together, the mountain and me, until only the mountain remains. Can you feel the movement there? Right? Starts out as a subject and an object. The birds have vanished into the sky. I'm looking into the sky. Right? And now the last cloud drains away. I see the cloud. We sit together, the mountain and me, that's the dualistic perspective, until only the mountain remains. Yeah? And this gives us a sense of why so many of us love being in nature, especially beautiful natural settings, the way that we do. Because for a lot of us, there will be these moments in nature of what some people call momentary enlightenment, where the boundaries dissolve in the way they did for Li Po, or for the person who wrote me about the hummingbird, and there's a glimpse of what in Buddhism we would call our true nature. Yeah. What that does for us, even when it contracts again, there's a part of us that knows what we experienced and what we saw. Yeah. It inspires us to practice in many cases. It encourages us and feels like a sign that we're moving along in terms of cultivation of wisdom, understanding, and awareness. Right? Sometimes these things happen spontaneously. Those of us who have been to retreats or done intensive practice probably have had these moments happen more frequently, because that environment sets up the causes and conditions, as they're called in Buddhist training, that support those kind of moments. I'll give you one more example, just so that you can get a good, clear feel for this, and then we'll move on and talk about something else, right? This one was written by a poet named Elizabeth Heron, and she describes her experience, right? I was depressed. The world had gone flat and colorless. I had withdrawn. I was a tiny kernel inside my body, adrift amid necessities and obligations, oppressed by my separateness, cut off from the wellsprings of my soul. I walked up to the pond, took off my clothes, and plunged into the water. A sudden shock, cold against my skin. Floating to the surface, I heard a bird call across the meadow. Suddenly, I was at the still point. The bird's call was my voice. We were separate and yet one. I was out there and in here. All things converged in me and radiated from me. Quote, the center of the circle is everywhere. The circumference is nowhere. I recognize this, knowing that it had always been so, though I had been cut off from my experience of it. My head filled with poetic images. The dimension of the infinite was everywhere. So these are experiences of enlightenment, or what I would call awakened consciousness. Yeah. And they plant seeds, and they help us to understand something that almost all of us, perhaps all of us here, have intuitively understood. Right? That there's much more to who and what we are and what our lives are about than appears to us much of the time. Because the deep conditioning that affects who we think we are and how we understand the world has us in such a grip. Yeah. Ram Dass talked about this years ago when he wrote Be Here Now in the early 70s. And he said, what is happening to you is nothing less than death and rebirth. What is dying is who you thought you were and how you understood how it all is. What is being reborn is a child of the Spirit for whom all things are new. Be gentle with this process because it is awesome. And this was before awesome was such a popular adjective, right? And then he said, learn to let go of the small self so that you may be reborn into your true nature. And what this suggests to us is that there's a level upon which enlightenment can be a moment-to-moment experience. Because when we really look very closely at what's happening, we can see that in each moment, on a certain level, there's a sense of being born and dying. It's a little bit like what happens when you look at a movie marquee. And you're standing off in the distance. It looks like a continuous line. Right? If you walk toward that movie marquee and get close enough, what do you see? You see flashing bulbs. Right? And if you look really, really closely and stand nearby, you can see that there's a little space between those. And they just appear to be continuous. So when we talk about these kinds of experiences, it's as if the solidity of the sense of self starts to dissolve and open up a little bit. And we realize that there's a different way to understand who and what we are than someone who's solid and static and who has been continuously the same self from the day they were born. Right? Yes, we have a sense of self that's continuous throughout the lifespan. That's true. Right? Yes, we have a personal history and we have a memory of it. But if we actually look really, really closely at the nature of that process, it turns out that what we call the self is itself a process. Biologists would tell us, for example, that there's not one cell in any of our bodies right now that was there 7 years ago. Right? So there's a continuous process of change going on. Right? So what does all this mean in terms of our practice and our lives, and what are some of the practical implications of what we're talking about here? One thing that comes into play is that, that helped me so much, actually. Jack Kornfield wrote a book some years back called Bringing Home the Dharma. And I've been wrestling pretty hard with these different perspectives on enlightenment and how to understand it, and was it just a kind of pie in the sky that I would forever be approaching and it would be a receding horizon of some sort? Or was it something that could actually be a part of my life on the level of felt experience and something that I had access to? Yeah. What Jack said in his book, there's a chapter in this book, Bringing Home the Dharma, called Enlightenments, Plural. And what he pointed out that I think was helpful is that it is true, and he recognized this in his own time in Asia when he practiced as a monk, that different teachers and different schools of practice presented the notion of enlightenment in different ways. Yeah. Even people that he respected and studied with and trained with, some Burmese teachers and some Thai teachers when he was a monastic. Mahasi Sayadaw, who was one of the people who greatly has influenced the insight meditation practice as it's practiced in this country, was someone who Jack trained and studied with, for example. And some of you are familiar with his approach. It involves, and what is emphasized is, long intensive practice periods, long retreats, yeah, using a mental noting technique on a moment-to-moment basis in an incredibly meticulous manner. And when one does this over a long enough period of time and with enough commitment and energy, what starts to happen is what we thought to be ourself as a solid entity begins to break down into elemental parts. For example, when we were sitting and meditating this evening, those of you who were with the meditation or when you've meditated on your own, right? If I'm sitting here and I'm paying attention to the sound of a siren and then the sensation of my breath and then an ache in my low back and then a thought, maybe I should see a chiropractor, and then the sound of traffic, and then I hear someone sneeze, yeah? The question that's built into the exploration of that is, where's David in all of that? Is David the sound of the siren? Is David the ache in the low back? Is David the sound of the stream, the sneeze? Which one's David? This is like the adult version of that children's book that my daughter likes so much called Where's Waldo? Right? You can't find him anywhere in the story. But this is why in Buddhist language there's a word that's translated as mind stream. Right? And when we talk about the Buddhist path of insight, there's four stages, the first of which is called entering the stream or becoming a stream enterer. Right? And that is coming to see ourselves as this process that's happening on a moment-to-moment basis, right? So on one level, yes, we are an individual. We have a personality and a body, and we need to know how to function on that level as a separate being, right? That's very important. That's what being grounded or being centered is about. At the very same moment, we come to see that there's another dimension to who we are, that these people in the readings I did experience, the man with the hummingbird, or the woman who dove into the pond. Yeah. That was the same person, but they experienced themselves in a radically different way that was fully open and fully aware and literally not separate from anything. Yeah. Jack talked about how confusing it was for him to also study with Achan Cha, who was his primary mentor and primary teacher when he was a monk in Thailand, in the forest monastery. And Achan Cha didn't emphasize the kind of technique or approach to meditation that Mahasi Sayadaw did. Rather, he didn't see meditation as the vehicle or as an end in itself. He saw it as a way to quiet down the mind so that Jack could learn to be mindful on a moment-to-moment basis, but not so microscopically, but going through life and practicing what we would call meditation in action. Right? Could he pay attention from the moment he got up to the moment he went to sleep, to what he was doing, just going about his day, taking a shower? Could he be present? Right? Talking to another monk, if necessary. Could he be present in the conversation and not preoccupied in thought? Right? So that Achan Cha's emphasis in enlightenment and awakening was, can you live throughout the day in a conscious and present manner? That's a different kind of emphasis. It's not a different experience, ultimately, I suspect. But even that's an interesting question. When we look at other traditions, we see similar differences, right? Tibetan practices that I trained in when I was in Nepal, the practice was called the Lam Rim, the graded path. There were many, many different steps and stages. It seemed almost overwhelming starting at the bottom and looking up the stairs like the ones we just went down, right? And the Tibetans presented their version of enlightenment, and it had a different flavor to it. So what are we really talking about here? What I'd suggest to you, and this is an image that Jack used in this chapter in his book, was that it's helpful to think of enlightenment as a jewel, like a diamond or a mandala, with many facets to it. Yeah? And different practice traditions and different teachers, as well as different personalities, emphasize different facets. Another teacher that Jack studied with over the years, some of you might have known, I had the good fortune to study with at one point, was a wonderful Bengali teacher named Deepa Ma. Came to the Insight Meditation Society in 1980 when I was on the 3-month course. And she lived with us for 6 weeks while we were on retreat. Yeah. Little tiny woman, less than 5 feet tall, amazingly courageous and powerful, who'd had a very difficult life with many losses, but she was like a walking statement of love. Right? The facet that she demonstrated was the facet that we call metta, loving kindness, or what we in the West might call unconditional love. Yeah. That's what she emphasized. Thich Nhat Hanh, another teacher that many of us have had the good fortune to learn from, who's written many, many books and traveled all over the world before he died not all that long ago. Yeah. Thich Nhat Hanh made it very clear that mindfulness was what mattered most. His emphasis was on paying attention and going through life with a compassionate heart and being clear and mindful and present. Yeah. As one teacher said to us, it's simple, but not easy. And why is it not easy? Because of the conditioning of our habits and the habit patterns that all of us, by virtue of being human, have. Yeah. That's not a judgment or a criticism. It's a simple fact of life. In the same way that the first noble truth is an existential reality. Yeah, life includes difficulty or suffering at times for every human being. Yeah. When we look at the text as well, we see that these different aspects of enlightenment are focused on more in certain texts than others. Some texts describe enlightenment quite straightforwardly, particularly in the Theravada tradition, as any time we act with an absence of greed, hatred, and delusion. Right? When our motives and intentions are devoid of greed, hatred, and delusion, our Buddha nature, what one of my teachers called our basic goodness, expresses itself through us like sunlight. Yeah. Other teachings talk about emptiness of self, the spaciousness that we feel when we let go of identification with the contracted self and we experience a kind of vast space, this non-dual quality that we talked about before. And yet other teachers talk about the positive. If you look at certain scriptures, enlightenment is described as pure love, like with Deepama. It's described as freedom, as we talked about here. It's described as infinite compassion in some cases. Because, of course, if we're not separate from everyone and everything, and we're in the presence of suffering, compassion is a natural, organic response. It's not a should or an ought. But if I'm not separate from you and you talk to me about your suffering, my heart will open instantly because we're not so separate, if you will. Yeah. So let's just... All right, well, so if we have this notion of enlightenments, right, different facets of the jewel that different people relate to and express as a dominant feature of how they embody and express awakened or enlightened consciousness, it's a useful question to consider what kinds of practices and methods are most helpful to work with. Let's just take a look at some of these. Right, in the insight meditation tradition specifically, the three main doors into enlightenment are what are sometimes called the three characteristics, also called the three marks of existence. Right? Sometimes you'll see it translated as the three facts. Right, those being anicca, impermanence, that literally anything we look at, from the most subatomic level to the intergalactic level, is itself a process if we look closely enough. Yeah. In that sense, there's really, in a literal sense, nothing to hold on to. Right. This can be considered very frightening and upsetting and bad news on one level, unless we're interested in what Alan Watts years ago called the wisdom of insecurity, where we realize we can surrender to the process nature of life and then, in a way, align with it and yield to it. This is one reason the word surrender shows up across so many spiritual traditions. And as I think a lot of us know, we live in a culture that is largely obsessed with control, manipulation, and mastery. Particularly Eastern contemplative teachings are trying to teach us about what in China is called yin energy, the feminine energy that understands how to yield and open and be with rather than exert agency and control and manipulate. Yeah. When we talk about impermanence, we'll get glimpses in our practice. What are we doing when we're sitting and meditating, doing insight practice? We're seeing the impermanent nature of the mind-body process. And when I listed all of the different things that would go through my experience when I was sitting earlier, the sound of the siren, the sensations in my body, the thoughts, the sound of someone coughing or sneezing, right? That's the mind stream that we can surrender into and make peace with rather than resist and struggle against. Yeah. So one set of practices to work with that help us to actualize our potential for enlightenment involves engaging with impermanence. Right? Sometimes we see this in a very powerful way. There was a point when I was in Nepal when I had a dream that was a real life-changing experience for me. In the dream, I was way out in outer space, a little bit like you talked about when you talked about the telescope, right? Way, way out in deep space. I was looking back at the Earth, right? And between where I was, I couldn't see myself. I could just see what my eyes saw. Between what I was seeing and the Earth was a rainbow mandala that was shimmering and translucent in such a way that it cast a rainbow image onto the Earth, and the whole Earth shimmered. Yeah. And the understanding that I had at that moment, which was not a new concept, but it was a whole body experience, was that all of life, all of what happened on Earth, all of what happened in my life and everyone's life was a field of energy that was constantly changing. And what was new about it was it moved to a deeper felt level of experience in my body and in my heart. So rather than conceptually understanding it, which is something that is fairly easy to do when we read Dharma books, there was a movement from what's called conceptualization to realization, where it becomes an embodied fact, an embodied truth, something that is real in a much deeper way. Yeah. And ironically, I was out at that time in Nepal I was planning to buy a tanka, like some of the art that we have in this building, of Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion. And the next morning I walked into a shop in the Tamil district in Kathmandu, and on the wall in the shop was a tanka with the exact image I had seen in the dream. A rainbow mandala, right? And of course, I dropped back to Earth very quickly because I knew I had to have it to take back when I went back to the U.S. And my first thought was, God, I hope that's not too expensive. And I've had that in my home office ever since. And whenever my eyes land on it, it's a reminder of this process nature, this impermanent nature of what we are, and the fact that we can trust it and relax into it rather than fear it and struggle against it. Yeah. Two other avenues in terms of these three characteristics. The second one has to do with suffering, right? The nature of suffering. How does that work? Well, as I think a lot of us have experienced, there's a way in which when we learn to be mindful and self-compassionate with our own suffering, one thing that starts to happen is we start to recognize that our suffering can become a gateway to the cultivation of a compassionate heart. Yeah? One of the biggest events in my life when I was growing up was when my father died suddenly of a heart attack when I was 13 years old. You know, I was out at a Little League baseball game, came home, there was a note on the table, stay home. We took Daddy to the hospital, never saw him again alive. Yeah. Now, fast forward 20 years. At 33, what am I doing for work? I'm directing a hospice program. Not by accident, but because that experience and others like it gave me a particular affinity for the kind of suffering associated with traumatic grief and loss. Yeah. Right. And so another gateway here is to understand that what feels like my pain, my father's death, right, can turn into what Stephen Levine, another teacher, called the pain, recognizing that my grief may be unique, and yet grief is universal. So if I've experienced grief and I sit down with you and you tell me about your grief, I'll be able to connect with you and experience us on the universal level as shared humanity. Yeah. So any practice that helps us to recognize the way that our suffering can become a gateway to compassion enables us to see that suffering from a spiritual standpoint is functional. It's clearly not desirable. I wouldn't wish it on myself or anybody else. However, because it's unavoidable, if we can learn to turn toward it and open into it with mindfulness and compassion, we can come to understand what Tibetans call turning poison into medicine. Another teacher here in the West called that turning straw into gold. Because if you think about your own life, in my many years of working in clinical practice as a psychologist and psychotherapist, one of the things I heard on many occasions was people say things like, this cancer has been the most important teacher I've had in my entire life. Not that they would have wanted it, but sometimes the most difficult parts of our lives teach us some of the most important life lessons and open us to some of the most important spiritual truths. So we can go through the door of impermanence, work with practices that help heighten our awareness of that. We can go through the door of suffering and recognize the way in which that can become a gateway to compassion and open us to our larger self or true nature. And then we can go through the gate of selflessness, right? As I talked about with Mahasi Sayadaw, or like the man with the hummingbird experienced, right? He felt himself dissolve as a separate person in the presence of the hummingbird, and there was just what was happening. And that's another gate that we can go through. There's actually many others, but the other that's interesting and relevant here, let's see if I brought this. No, I didn't bring this up. There's another one called the gateless gate. And what the gateless gate basically involves is, rather than dramatic, powerful, sudden experiences like the ones I've shared and talked about, there's a teacher who talked in one of Jack's other books called, what's his book about the laundry? After the Ecstasy, the Laundry. Right. Yeah, thank you. One of the teachers in there talks about her experience of interviewing people over many years as a teacher who would come in with these dramatic experiences, and she never had any experience of that at all. Right? She just continuously committed to her practice day after day, time after time, sat, went to retreats, studied, and just very, very gradually started to realize that she was becoming the kind of person that she was reading about in all of these books. Right? Nothing special, just ordinary life with the intention to see it as a curriculum for awakening, to pay attention with mindfulness and compassion, and the rest unfolded by itself. Yeah. That's what we call the gateless gate. Yeah. So what is it I'm trying to say here? Let's see if I can sum this up. I want to allow a little bit of time for conversation. Bear with me one sec. So this is what I'm suggesting to you. At any point in your practice, I would suggest it could be useful to take a fresh look at how you're understanding the word enlightenment. Yeah. Not that there's a right way or a way that you should understand it, because I think we could make a case for what we call the spiritual path as being a continually evolving understanding of what the word means. Yeah. If you think about what it meant to you the first time you went to a Dharma talk, right? and think about what it means to you now. Hopefully, it's different. Yeah, it will continue to evolve, right? But the key here is to realize that it's not something that we have to grasp after. It's not something that we have to chase. It's something that's innate within us. Yeah. The beauty of being human is that as we own rather than bypass our humanness, as we fully embrace what it means to be a human being, the vulnerability, the fragility, the challenge and the suffering, right? In that process, we come to also actualize another human capacity, which is the innate capacity for self-transcendence. It's built into us. Yeah. And by embracing our full humanness, we come to know that dimension of us, which we in Buddhism would call Buddha nature, our true self. Yeah. It opens to us as we open more deeply to our humanity. Yeah. So I'll close with a vision of awakening that currently speaks to me and resonates with my own experience. And then we can have some conversation if you'd like. This one is by Pema Chodron. Spiritual awakening is frequently described as a journey to the top of a mountain. We leave our attachments and our worldliness behind and slowly make our way to the top. At the peak, we have transcended all pain. The only problem with this metaphor is that we leave all the others behind. Our drunken brother, our schizophrenic sister, our tormented animals and friends. Their suffering continues, unrelieved by our personal escape. In the process of discovering our true nature, the journey goes down, not up. It's as if the mountain pointed toward the center of the earth instead of reaching into the sky. Instead of transcending the suffering of all creatures, we lean toward the turbulence and the doubt. We jump into it. We slide into it. We tiptoe into it. We move toward it however we can. We explore the reality and unpredictability of insecurity and pain, and we try not to push it all away. If it takes years, if it takes lifetimes, we will let it be as it is, at our own pace, without speed or aggression. We move down and down and down. With us move millions of others, our companions in awakening from fear. At the bottom, we discover water, the healing water of compassion. Right down there in the thick of things, we discover the love that will not die. I'd like to stop here, but I appreciate your coming and your attention and spending this time with you. So I thank you all.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.